Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age's continuing recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for joining us as usual, and we are going to continue on with Chapter 32.
A couple of things that should be noted before we begin our recap today. First and foremost, it should be noted that we're doing a recap of the 12th book of the Wheel of Time series. As a result, we're probably going to talk about the previous 11 books, the prequel, and, you know, sometimes other things that aren't Wheel of Time but may be related in some way, shape, or form. There are going to be spoilers. Please, 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 if you don't want to be spoiled and you haven't read through book 12, don't listen to this podcast. Come back to it later when you've got time and you've read through things, because, you know, we don't want to ruin the experience for other people. And, you know, sometimes things like that just happen and it's never, never fun.
No, and we have been known to also spoil the endings of other series inadvertently, which we will try very hard not to do, and yeah, it's not fun. As the wolves would say, spoilers. Many, many, many.
Yes. The other thing that should be mentioned, some of you may have noticed during the course of this recap that I have been absent quite a bit. The reason for this is that right around the beginning of us recording our chapter summaries, I started a master's program in literature, and just every now and then, the schedule for my schoolwork, which is amazingly important that I really, really keep up with, just kind of gets in the way of our recording time. So I am not disappearing, but every now and then I just might not be here for an episode or two. So I just figured that I would let you all know, in case any of you were disturbed by, you know, the sudden lack of Andrew that appears every occasionally over the course of this. It is for a better cause. So
we need our Andrew fix. I mean, we just, you know, you can't just not show up. I do have to say, in Andrew's defense, we have been on major crush mode. I know you guys probably can't tell because we don't get stuff out fast enough, but in order to facilitate actually getting this read-through of The Gathering Storm done before the release of Towers of Midnight, we have been recording sometimes three times a week, sometimes two episodes back-to-back, because even though we started this in August, we suddenly realized, oh, there are a lot of chapters in the Gathering Storm. We better really crack on this. So it's been kind of tough on everybody. We're really toying hard to get this out, and we're hoping to start releasing these. And then to compound matters, the reboot of DragonMount.com has sort of disabled the podcast for a while. Any of you that are catching up now and noticed, that we're regular listeners, noticed a big gap, that was also part of the problem. We haven't been able to post any podcasts for quite some time. So we have a stack of them left to go. By the time you hear this, hopefully, you know, there will have been a plethora of podcasts posted. How's that for alliteration?
There we go. All right, we'll begin this episode, as Virginia said, with Chapter 32, Rivers of Shadow. Nynaeve, Maurice, Cadswain, Corell, and Dahmer Flynn stand on the city wall of Bandar Iban at midnight to observe a ghostly fog that seems to be a funeral procession. Nynaeve still feels the storm to the north. She can never go back to the Two Rivers, she thinks. She's Aes Sedai and married to Lon, a king. The eerie fog began appearing the night after Rand arrived. Incidents like bubbles of evil are happening more often after coming down from the wall. They head back to the mansion. On the way, Nynaeve stops to heal a boy with the white shakes. Now she tries to think how she can gain Rand's confidence. Cad Swain failed, and she is failing so far, she thinks. The only one who succeeded with her in working with him at all was Moraine. She decides to show Rand how she can be useful to him. As she enters the mansion grounds, Hastur Nalmut, a Saldan officer on duty, bows to her. Inside the gates, she commands three soldiers. In the mansion, she sends servants for the Dosun, the head housekeeper. Laurel arrives soon, and Eve asks her where the messenger was imprisoned and questioned. She and four of the servants lead Nynaeve and the soldiers to the Gull's Feast, an area near the docks where fishermen dump waste. On the way, she wonders what is happening at the White Tower. The news on Egwene, Elida, and the Ashaman is all garbled. They reach the Chandler's shop. Nynaeve leaves one of the soldiers to stay with the servants and the Dosun, while the other two, Tribbin and Lurtz, accompany her. They break into the shop and find two guards and the questioner upstairs. Back downstairs, there is a young Damani man, the apprentice. They enter the basement through a trap door and find a hidden dungeon. Milisir Chodmar is in the cell. Nynaeve questions them about the messenger, but Jorgen, the questioner, insists that he just died. One of the thugs is named Mord. Jorgen convinces her he is telling the truth. Before she leaves, she checks on Milisar and finds that she was poisoned with Tarchet leaf. Jorgen says that the apprentice, Curb, prepared all of the food, both for Milisar and for the messenger. Hurrying back upstairs, they find the front door open, but the four servants grabbed Curb as he tried to run away.
This is kind of a strange chapter to me. I realize that it needs to be there and set up for later things, but it seems odd. I think this is one of the first times that also that we see Nynaeve really refer to Lan as a king. I mean, he is a king, but he's an uncrowned king, and he has no nation to be a king of at the moment. So it's kind of odd that she's reflecting on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. One of the things about Lan that they've always mentioned, and I mean, they mentioned it particularly in New Spring, that, you know, he had presence enough for a king. You know, the way he acts in the honor code he lives by makes him, to people who don't really know him, seem kingly. I mean, it's kind of playing off that, you know, sort of Aragorn from Lord of the Rings kind of vibe, you know, the king in exile, the king as wandering knight type thing. Yeah, no, this chapter was interesting because, or for me, because I think Nynaeve has touches in this chapter of both Nynaeve the Aes Sedai, you know, the one who thinks in, you know, the manipulations and the schemes and the, you know, not just the immediacy, and at the same time, we also get traces of Nynaeve the Wisdom. You know, we get her, you know, stopping to heal this random boy. And, you know, it's not as if he's right out in the plain open. She has to track him down to find him. While she uses her mystique as an Aes Sedai in that, I mean, she really kind of bullies the parents like a Wisdom. And then again, when they come into the dungeon, you know, it's not really, I mean, it is in part, you know, the healing that she uses, but at the same time, you know, it's the recognition of Tarchet leaf and everything. I mean, that's all Wisdom and the herbs and everything that Nynaeve grew up with. I mean, it was made easier by the One Power, but she could have theoretically come in and, you know, that little taste of what Milisar had and recognize what was going on without the One Power at all, if she really, really had to. So, you know, I thought it was really neat because, you know, we did kind of get that play that we haven't had for a while between who Nynaeve was and who she is. And I think part of that also goes back to her thinking, you know, she can't go back to the Two Rivers because she's Aes Sedai. I mean, the thought that, you know, Aes Sedai don't really have a place in the Two Rivers is an interesting illusion that, you know, we've seen a couple of times. I mean, both times there have been real Aes Sedai down in the Two Rivers. There have been drastic problems. You know, Winter's Night first, and then the entire secondary invasion that Perrin had to fight off with Varen and Alana's help.
That's true, but they did cope with the Aes Sedai in the Two Rivers pretty well toward the end, you know, when they were battle in the Trollocs with them and everything, it seemed like the Two Rivers people eventually just came to accept the fact that they were Aes Sedai, and they had their three Aiel there, and they had their Ogier there, and it's like, okay, this is where it is now. The Golden Eyes has changed everything.
Oh yeah, but I mean, I think at the same time, there is that sense that, you know, going home, going to the Two Rivers means a reset to how things were. And I mean, that's kind of reflected on, sadly, whenever someone goes there in Teleron Riad and notices how much change there's been in the Two Rivers. You know, the palisade, the wall, the manor, and, you know, all that stuff, and just the sort of, you know, the idea that even in 2 years' time, so much can change that, you know, home isn't necessarily what it used to be anymore.
Yeah, I don't think really that, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's not going to be a homecoming for any of these characters the way there was in the Rings. I mean, these guys can't go back to the Two Rivers and just fit in. It's just, they've grown too much. They have grown and done and seen too much. I think Perrin would probably be the closest, but even he's never going to be able to go back and seriously just become a blacksmith again. I mean, he may be able to shoe his own horses now that he's a lord if he really wants to, but I don't think it's going to really happen, and I think that he's going to have so many other duties. Eventually, he'll just get over that. A lot of that's just homesickness, you know, and of course, Perrin's sort of emo, ongoing whining, you know.
Yeah.
That I think he'll never really put aside, and when he's, I'm quite sure, well, maybe not, but it seems pretty likely to me that when he ever does get back to the Two Rivers and he's running things, he'll still be emo Perrin whining after the adventures and wondering why he can't ever do any fun anymore, you know? It's sort of the human nature to never be happy with what you have, always wanting what you had or what you think you should have. But apart from him, I just can't see any of them going back to the Two Rivers and fitting in smoothly. It's just, there's nothing there for them anymore, even though the Two Rivers is not the backwater that it was. I mean, what's an Aes Sedai going to do there? There's nothing going on. There's no plotting. There's no anything. I mean, that's even assuming that the Two Rivers survives the breaking, if there is a physical breaking.
Yeah.
We don't know. I mean, that could be, that could be one of the real twists in the last battle, that not only can they not go back to the Two Rivers, but the Two Rivers is gone. And maybe one of them will have to destroy it in order to, you know, save the larger world, you know. And how would that fit in with their mindsets? That would destroy a couple of them pretty much. Or
yeah,
close
true.
To it. Anyway.
I had a thought first couple of times I've read this, because it seems extremely out of place to me. Like, the village from Shota rising out of the ground and, you know, sinking back into the earth, I can get. And, you know, ghosts appearing even in larger numbers, like, you know, the entire train of people in Darluna, makes sense to me. This seems odd because they're on top of the wall and the mist rolls in. And the mist is something we've not seen in connection with ghosts either yet, if I've not mistaken. And then this funeral procession begins. And it's not just that it's a funeral procession, it's the same funeral procession every night. And it started right after Rand showed up. And I'm not wondering if this isn't less a reflection of things that have happened, but because reality as we have seen it is kind of starting to go wonky on us, particularly around Rand, if it's not one of those possibilities of what may happen. I mean, obviously, I don't think we see the funeral procession anywhere but in Urband or Ebon to say that, you know, hey, this weird funeral procession is following us around. But it seemed to me that it resonated really oddly with me, that it seemed significant that it was a funeral procession and for someone important. And it just so happens to start right after Rand appears in the city.
Yeah. Well, the fog and the mist obviously remind me of the bubble of evil, you know, outside of Carrion that destroyed the tents and interrupted the battle that Rand, the mock battle that Rand was having with Torm Riatan. I can't never get his name right. Torm Riatan. And then there was also, Nat's Red Arms brought him stories of a fog in the Rahad when they were in Nebadar. So apparently the fog is a real harbinger of strangeness and bubbles of evil, but this isn't really a bubble of evil. This is it's more like the ghost, you know, coming through. And I'm sure that, I'm just as sure as I can be that the reason that this happens so much around Rand is because he's so strongly Taviran, and the pattern is already weakening. Just his very presence must be a strain on the fabric of reality and the pattern itself at this point. I mean, he can bend the pattern around him by his very Taviran-ness, and now he's actually realized that he can bend it around him on purpose. He can actually will something to happen, and it's probably going to happen. And that, to me, is one of the scariest things that I've come across in The Gathering Storm. That is so much power in addition to what he already wields. You know, it's really scary, but that's gonna be a bit of a strain on everything. So we could certainly expect more and more things like this to happen and happen more strongly closer to him. But the other thing that we haven't seen back again, as far as I can tell, are the ripples that Fael felt when they were in Maldon. I thought that was actually one of the most horrifying scenes in the entire book. I mean, the idea of reality rippling and wavering and shifting like that right around you, where everybody can feel it, everybody's struck by it, thoughts of what just happened. You know.
Yeah.
Whoa. Well, and then of course there was the scene with, has that happened already? The scene with, yeah, the scene with Lyanna in the cells.
Yes.
Sinking into the stone. Yeah, okay. Yeah, and then of course the scene with Lyanna sinking into the stones and the white cow beyond creepy too. So the whole setup for all of this is the weirdness. It's just too much. And it actually kind of worries me. I'm 100% convinced that Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson will be able to carry this off. But if this were any other author, I would be worried that there's so much going on and spinning out of control. I don't know how they're going to be able to resolve this in any kind of sensible manner. Yeah, all these things start happening, and I start looking for one of those, you know, dime store endings where the heroes are all charging into some completely unsurvivable situation or whatever, and in the next scene you see them walking back out going, wow, that was a tough one. Glad we made it, you know. You don't know how or why or whatever. You know, they're hanging off a cliff and suddenly they're, oh man, that one. But you don't know how because they couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen here, but it just gives me the creeps when I see all this stuff going on.
Yeah. I think one of the other really, I don't know, it is an increase, again, in the narrative debt to the audience. Once again, we get someone thinking to themselves that the only person who ever succeeded in working with Rand was Moraine. And,
yep.
You know, and of course, at this point in the last book, we've gotten the letter. We know Moraine is still alive, and we're desperately hoping that she's going to be back in this book. And of course, yeah. So it seems like, you know, the more she gets mentioned, the more it ratchets up that tension of, you know, oh, we need Moraine back. We need her back. We need her back. And it does. It seems like up until this point, the only thing we really had that said we absolutely needed Moraine back was a vision that Min has never described to us. You know, only the idea that Rand couldn't succeed without a woman who was dead and gone, and that Moraine was the only vision that did not come to pass for her.
Yeah,
so
I think she
like,
said Rand would almost certainly fail without a woman who was dead and gone. Almost certainly. That's pretty strong coming from men, although she hardly ever did if, you know, and maybes. It was usually that. But then again, she didn't want to believe that, so maybe she was qualifying it in her mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I guess I'm just getting so bored. We've had so many tricky little things happen throughout the book, and I think it's only going to get worse because if anybody is, pardon me, Brandon, sneaky and tricky, it's you. I'm really worried that she'll come back and it'll be like, oh my God, she's stilled, or, you know, she'll come back and she'll go, well, okay, I'm back. I'm out of here. See you guys. I don't know. I mean, I just, I don't want to be much more inventive or creative than that, but they're building Moraine up as the necessary savior coming back basically from the grave. And I'm just getting paranoid that there's going to be some twist there that's going to make that not nearly as satisfying as we're all hoping. I mean, they're building her up to this massive contribution. So what is it really going to be?
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, you know, she's not the one who's going to fight the last battle. This is the kind of build-up I would expect if Rand had gone missing into the Tower of Genjai. I forgot how Maria pronounced it. Anyway, this is the kind of build-up that I expect if a major character like Rand had gone into the Tower of Genjai and was expected to come back or was feared not to be able to come back. And I just don't know if Moraine can, I don't know if there's a way that to fulfill all of the expectations we've built up over all these many books. I hope so, because I really miss Moraine. I want to see her and Tom get together, too. Okay, so I guess that'll wrap up that chapter, which is chapter 33, entitled A Conversation with the Dragon. This one begins with Nynaeve's point of view. Back at the mansion, Rand and Min respond to Nynaeve's urgent summons. Curb is tied up in flows of air. Rand is extremely annoyed until Nynaeve tells him the story of what happened. Curb was poisoning Millisair, and he poisoned the messenger as well. There is a block on his mind. Rand says it is Grendel's compulsion, and Nynaeve shivers as she remembers Mogedion. Rand questions the boy and imposes his will, but the boy cannot speak. Nynaeve's tea is suddenly spoiled as she's drinking it, and bitter. Rand then coaches Nynaeve on removing the compulsion. She does not want to do this, but there is no one else there, even Corell, who could possibly do it. After she is finished, Curb is a bare shell of a mind. Rand questions him again, and he whispers Natrin's barrow, and then dies. Nynaeve is angry that he could not be healed, but Rand is heartless. She tells Rand that his anger will destroy him, and he agrees, shocking her. He tells her a story from Tam that no one has ever climbed Dragon Mount because after reaching the top, they would be too exhausted to climb down and so would die up there. Rand only has to reach the last battle, and this is obviously the analogy that he's making. He will die at that point, so there does not need to be anything left of him to salvage. He can accept Nynaeve because she truly cares about him, unlike Cadswain. Min has fallen asleep, so he carries her back to his rooms. He tells Nynaeve that he will deal with the Shan Chen first, then Grendel.
There's an interesting little note at the end of this particular chapter that the Tam story of Dragon Mount is nice as a story, but in all reality, Dragon Mount's probably more than 4 miles high. So the air at that point is going to be too thin to support normal human life for very long. Yeah, this is also why, it's such a monumentally gigantic mountain. The concept of, it's not necessarily that a person would be too exhausted from climbing up it. It's just that, as we've seen with the many people who've tried to climb Mount Everest and not manage to make it all the way, it's just physically less feasible to do so, and especially in a world where you don't have things like rebreathers and other sorts of mountain climbing equipment. The concept of climbing Dragon Mount is a daunting one, apparently, considering that people mention that the lower sides of the mountain are strewn with skulls and stuff of people who have tried to climb it and failed.
Yeah, I was initially going to insert something here about how I didn't think it was possible that it was 4 miles high, but then I looked up Mount Everest, which is over 29,000 feet high, so that shut down that theory of mine. considering that Dragon Mount is a man-made artifact, basically, and from all descriptions of it, probably far steeper than a natural mountain like Everest, I think that it would be pretty difficult for anybody to actually make it up there without, I mean, it's not something you could just walk up. For the most part, I think they would have to spend a lot of time, with actual rock climbing gear. So I don't know. It just seems unlikely that anybody would even attempt it in that day and age. Like you say, they didn't have any mountain climbing gear or oxygen or any of that stuff. I suppose a Chandler, might be able to do it with the assistance of the One Power, but that would be the point. You could just travel to the top of it and there you are. Wouldn't be able to breathe up there, actually, I don't think. 4 miles, a lot of oxygen up there.
It's pretty thin up there. I was really impressed by what Rand actually says there. I expected Nynaeve to go off on him and, you'll destroy yourself if you don't turn away from this. And, his response is, yeah, I know. I don't know why all of you don't understand that I know this. He does. It's either this chapter, which I'm pretty sure it is, or it's one of the, or it's another one in which someone's telling him that, he's gonna destroy himself, and he's just like, and I'm almost 100% certain it is Nynaeve, because he says something to the effect of, Nynaeve, why is it that everyone, seems to think that I don't understand this? It's extremely logical. It's very dark and very cold. I continue to wonder, he said, glancing down at Min, why you all assume that I'm too dense to see what you find so obvious. Yes, Nynaeve. Yes, this hardness will destroy me. I know. you know, and even during the explanation, you know, he as he's saying all this, you know, he's looking at Nynaeve, but he's not really looking at her. He's not seeing her. I mean, he's staring at nothing. And, you know, and you can kind of tell that part of the reaction as he's saying this is him saying the words for himself. You know, he needs to hear that he's made this resolution, that he knows he's destroying himself, and that it's for the rest of the world, you know, that he, as a person, doesn't matter, which of course is part of the grand problem with Rand at this moment, is that he's too focused on the duty, the mountain, and its connection with the feather, with dying, that he doesn't see that there should be another option. Duty can be fulfilled without the death.
Yeah. I think there are also two little quotes here in this scene, basically, that still give a lot of insight into Rand. Even though he's hard and even though he's cold and he's made himself this stone of Quindiar or whatever he's becoming, there are two little glimpses that I think are kind of significant. And one is where the boy dies and Nynaeve demands, "Don't you feel any guilt at all?" And they look at each other. Nynaeve is frustrated and helpless. Rand, who could guess what Rand felt these days? And then he says, "Should I suffer for them all, Nynaeve?" He asks, quietly rising. "Face still half in the darkness. Lay this death at my feet if you wish. It will just be one of many. How many stones can you pile on a man's body before the weight stops mattering? How far can you burn a lump of flesh until further heat is irrelevant? If I let myself feel guilt for this boy, then I would need to feel guilt for the others, and it would crush me." And she regarded him in the half-light. A king, certainly. A soldier, though he had only occasionally seen war. She forced down her anger. Hadn't this all been about proving to him that he could trust her? And that's when she tells him that the thing without a heart, without an emotion, will destroy him. And then just a few paragraphs later, after he tells her the story about Dragonmount, she says, "But that's just a story, a legend." And he says, "That's what I am," Rand said. "A story, a legend, to be told to children years from now, spoken of in whispers." He shook his head. "Sometimes you can't turn back. You just have to keep pressing on. And sometimes, you know, this climb will be your last." I mean, it's really interesting how he views himself. And he's almost gone beyond the hardness and the coldness and making himself steel and making himself, you know, this and that. Now he doesn't even see himself as anything but a story or a legend. I mean, he's really become completely dissociated in a lot of ways. I mean, if you wanted to try and psychologically diagnose him, he's not only been, I mean, he's practically been schizophrenic already with all these other voices and people in his head, but he's actually lost a sense of himself, but he can still see what he was. It's really strange and kind of weird. It's like he's looking at himself in a story. And I guess he kind of had to do that because he's been telling himself for what, 2 years now that he's going to die. You know, he knows he's going to die. He's embraced that. And so he's just going on doing what he needs to do. It's just creepy, though.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even the ending of the chapter is creepy, you know, that Nynaeve is, you know, as Rand is leaving, she's wanting to yell at him that he's wrong, that there's always hope and, you know, all of this, and she can't. She, as a matter of fact, she thinks to herself, she can't even find the argument to be able to make it. You know, the fact that Nynaeve is somewhat, you know, seeing the sheer hopelessness of it is kind of profound, really.
I think one other interesting thing was that he tells her that he did well, you know, that she did well and had saved them all a lot of trouble. And then she sort of blurts out something because of his Taverness, I'm presuming. She says, "I did it because I wanted you to trust me." And then immediately cursed herself. Why did she do that? Was she really so tired that she blabbed the first thing that came to her mind? And Rand says, "I do trust you, Nynaeve, as much as I trust anyone, more than I trust most."
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. He actually does some trust for people, even though some people aren't seeing it.
Moving on to Chapter 34, Legends. Matt and the band are preparing to approach Trastare. After Hinderstap, Matt has developed an amazingly elaborate plan. He reviews Master Roydel's maps with Talmanis, Tom, Noel, Julian, and Mondavin. They will approach the inn, the Shaken Fist, where the pictures have come from. Thom will take Harnon, Fergin, and Mondavin with him. Talmanis will masquerade as a warder, borrowing Fenn's cloak. Afterwards, Matt walks through the camp. He reflects how his memories from the Ilfen have smoothly blended in with those of his own. He watches his crossbowmen practice and thinks that if they had a few banners of them at Bloodwash Falls, Nasheef would have learned his lesson sooner. He looks forward to reuniting with Estienne and Darid. As he walks through the camp, he decides that he will go and check on Aludra. Aegyanin has been helping her, and he reflects that Tuan is still on his mind quite a bit. Upon reaching Aludra's portion of the camp, Bail Domin is standing guard. She gives Matt a supply list for constructing her dragons. The quantities are huge, but she says that the Dragon Reborn can afford them, and Matt sees an image of Rand and feels a pull to go northward. She will need all the copper and tin and every bell founder in the land that Rand controls. Ulver arrives with news of a visitor. It turns out that it is Varen Sedai and her warder. She is the one who has been distributing the pictures of Matt and the others. A merchant arrived in Trastair an hour ago, and he told her he had drawn a map for Matt. Trastair is half a day away, so Matt realizes that Varen must now be able to travel. She says that she can have Matt and the band to Camelin by evening, saving him 20 days worth of marching. He asks what she wants, and she answers that she wants to be free of his Tavaren web. He follows after her to hear her story.
That's interesting. This is the first time that we've really heard an Aes Sedai specifically say that she was completely caught up and unable to escape the pool of the Tavaren. A few of them have kind of, you know, said things that they didn't want to do, but none of them have ever really said, I can't do what I want to do because of you being Tavaren. That I can recall, anyway.
Yes, and I mean, do we get the Varen story in this one, or do we get it in the next chapter? I think it's the next chapter. Or not the next one, but the one following. It's interesting because, I mean, Varen will actually go in and explain specifically how she was caught up, and I mean, that in itself is really getting more to the point of, you know, the Tavaren needing something. And it happening. I mean, we've quite a bit seen that, you know, Tavaren will just kind of miraculously spawn the stuff they need around them as it's happening. And, you know, it's the idea here that the pattern needs Matt in Camelin.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least somewhere further north than where he is. And Varen does provide the best possible way for him to get where he needs to be. And so there's the idea that, you know, in this case, we're actually seeing, you know, the pattern saying, no, we need this guy here. Let's work things so that this guy gets there.
I think it's interesting. She actually says, do you know how long you forced me to wait in these mountains? Well, that's kind of, wow. It almost makes me think that the guys are becoming more strongly to Varen as time goes on. I mean, Nat and Perrin haven't been bending the pattern around them to the extent that Rand is, but they're pretty strong to Varen. I would have to say they're probably equivalent to Arthur Hawkwind himself.
Definitely possible. I enjoyed, I know it's a little bit of silliness, but I also enjoyed in this chapter, Matt's plan. I mean, just the level of complexity with which he's going about this, and just because he wants to avoid another thing like Hinderstaff happening, you know, and of course, you know, the chances of something like Hinderstaff happening again is very, very minimal, but, you know, Matt's not going to take any chances, and so it's you know, the idea that they're going through various things, and just the depth with which, you know, like anybody is going to question, you know, the levels of, you know, someone's story. Someone comes in and says, hey, I'm a traveling merchant, he's a traveling merchant. But, you know, Matt takes it to, you know, at an amazingly extreme level. You know?
I mean, I know Tomanis even mocks him about it with his sneak out pages with elaborate backstories and aliases and everything, mm-hmm. and telling them to memorize it all. And Tomanis even says, let me guess, Matt, I'm a traveling merchant who once trained at the Aeolus, come to the village because he heard there's a trout that was in the lake who insulted his father. I don't know. It is funny, and I like it better than I did on the first reread, but I have to say that this was one of the chapters where I really tried really hard not to go through and figure out who had written most of what, but this, to me, was something that was a little bit out of character for Matt. It still it still jars with me. He's not at all literary. He's not a writer. He's not a, I mean, he might make up a story to get out of something, but this was just kind of just not, it doesn't like map to me. You know what I mean? It's really cute, but it just wasn't in character, I don't think. But it's okay.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, I feel that these sorts of things are kind of trying to bring back a little more of the comic relief that Matt provided in some of the earlier books. I mean, Matt looked each of the five men in the eyes, nodded, and started toward the tent flap, but paused beside Tomanus' chair. Matt cleared his throat and half mumbled, "You secretly harbor a love of painting, and you wish you could escape this life of death you've committed yourself to. You came through Trestea or on your way south rather than taking a more direct route because you love the mountains. You're hoping to hear word of your younger brother, whom you haven't seen in years, and who disappeared on a hunting trip in the in southern Andor. You have a very tortured past. Read page 4.
Yeah, I know. And then Talmadge rolls his eyes and he thinks, "Burn the man, there was good drama in those pages." No, it was cute as could be. It brought some of the comic relief back, but it just wasn't Matt. I'm sorry. In the whole book, he's probably written 5 words on purpose. I mean, you know, he sits down there and laboriously, in Evdar, he laboriously writes this very short note to Elaine and Nynaeve about something or another. You know, there are plenty of flies. There's nothing here but heat and flies. You can find plenty of those in Camelot, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, it takes him forever to write that. I can't see him writing pages of dialogue for his men. Excuse
me. Well, you know, Matt did have a lot of recovery time, though, in certain... You know, he's been months off of, you know, his feet at times because of the various things he's gone through. And, you know, with hanging out first with Thailand and then with Tuan, you know, I can kind of see there being a little more culture slipping in, you know, maybe.
Well, and I think the other thing, I know, it's pretty funny, but, and, you know, I suppose all that time he was tied up with the pink ribbons, he had plenty of time to think, but,
Well, and personally, on top of that, too, it is the person who is least accustomed to writing or to, you know, to think about this sort of stuff, who's going to go the most overboard. I mean, the concept that, I mean, Matt realizes that it's probably not going to take the most elaborate disguise in the world for things, but at the same time, it's like, you know, he writes pages.
Yeah.
Worth of backstory that will never come up. And, you know, and on some level I have to assume even Matt knows that they're never going to come up. But, you know, it's that, you know, well, I have to provide for every single contingency just in case because you know, who knows what they will ask.
It's really funny. I also thought, you know, good old Mandevin, who's not the brightest light in the world, he gives him this whole little story and then it tells him he's going to run away with somebody, and he says, "But I don't want to leave my great aunt. She's cared for me since I was a child."
You don't have a great aunt.
There is no great aunt. It's just like, okay. I guess to be ultimately nitpicky, it talks about pages covered in scrawled handwriting, and yet in Evdar, his handwriting was childish block letters, you know. I guess maybe, like I say, he's picked up literary pretensions and a tinge of culture from the ladies he's been hanging out with. Queens and empresses, I guess you can't be a complete dork all the time if you're going to hang out with nobility and royalty all the time.
Yeah,
that's pretty funny, though. I think the other thing that's really funny is the business with Aludra. She's back again with her dragons and so forth, and she gives him this huge list. And I mean, the materials. Oh my goodness! I don't know where he's going to come up with all this stuff in the backwoods that they're tracing through. I suppose in Camelot, you know, he can come up with a lot of it. But holy cow! I mean, she's gone overboard.
Well, I mean, she is trying to outfit multiple armies with these. I mean, I honestly think she's thinking on a level of where everyone else should be thinking as far as, you know, the last battle. That, I mean, they're going to need lots of artillery And when you really think about it, it's like if you're going to be running against, you know, Trollocs and Dreadlords and Murdrel and all sorts of Shadow Spawn and, you know, who knows what else, in addition to, you know, probably an actual army of Dark Friends, you know, plus, you know, the Forsaken, whatever happened to be there, and, you know, Chandler's going, you know, crazy all over the place. It's like, yeah, let's, time to break out the big guns.
Literally. Yeah, no, I totally agree with the need, and I think she's pretty smart to try and do this, but I'm thinking to myself, this is, you know, it's not the most advanced cultural milieu in the world. I mean, you need, in order to gear up for war on a basis like that, you know, you need the sort of infrastructure, say, that the Romans did, you know, where they've got a network of good roads, they've got, you know, they have officers dedicated to procurement, you know, they have infrastructure. You know, and it's just not going to be that easy. You know, these people are basically decades away from gearing up to building cannons, wholesale cannons and everything like that. I mean, anything's possible, but it just seemed a little bit odd to me. Maybe not decades, but years away. I mean, you just don't convert. How many Bell Founders could there be in the entire a number of Randland? And they're spread all over the place. I mean, people don't need that many Bells. You know what I mean? You know, you just don't build foundries and stuff like that on a large scale overnight. And that's almost what they're going to need to do. They only have, I'm thinking, months maybe until the last battle. And the other thing that kind of bothers me is that how great an idea are these cannons going to be against Dreadlords who can channel the first time one of them figures out that with a little bit of weave of the power, they can probably explode that thing in their faces.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much it's going to come into play that, you know, that they will be using the cannons against channelers. I mean, when it comes right down to it, yeah, a little bit of thought will eventually allow someone to realize what's going on. But I mean, when you're thinking about the assembled mass of the Blight, you know, yeah, point yeah. And click.
Yeah. I just know if I were assembling an army of people to deal with, you know, what they're doing in that state and time, I believe I'd have at least one channeler with pretty much every division just in case, maybe more. I had them, you know, sort of like the Shanchan do. You know, nobody goes anywhere without a couple of Damani and Soldan. You know, and it only takes one to really wreak some serious havoc.
Yeah.
Presumably the Forces of the Light will also have some channelers sprinkled through everything. But, I mean, you know, that the business with the Iula and everything would have maybe gone a lot differently if Savannah hadn't taken the vast majority of channelers with the Shaido with her. All the others were basically left, you know, basically arm in arms. You know, they had nothing else, just spears. So they're not letting me plan the battles, and I don't have any great pretense. I'm no Matt when it comes to planning battles, but I mean, sometimes it just takes a little common sense, too. That's the way, I don't know. Okay, maybe I'm making too much out of a little tiny bit of a detail. I guess we should make a passing mention of, actually, we should make more than a passing mention, and I didn't do this at the beginning. We are getting the chapter summaries basically cut from whole cloth provided by encyclopedia-watt.org, and you can go there and read these and follow each character, each significant object, place, character will have a link to its own page and description and everything. It's a fabulous resource, and we thank them very much for going to all that work. It's a great resource for anybody who's interested in the Wheel of Time, so I highly suggest you check it out. And they also have notes at the end of each of these chapter summaries, and one of them in this chapter deals with Matt's little reflection on the crossbowmen when he's watching them practice, thinking if he'd had a few banners across Bowman at Bloodwash Falls, now she would have learned his lesson sooner. This is obviously a little reference to his blended memories now that he basically can't tell his from all the others that were provided to him by the Ilfen. And there's no further information on when or where this event took place in the past. Just really kind of one of those little oddities. It's going to be one of those little asides thrown at us, like Brigitte's, you know, mentions of places and people from past times that she never explains. Anything else on that one that you want to bring up?
I think we're fairly good.
Okay, well, let's move on to, well, I think we pretty much covered that chapter. Let's move on to chapter 35, which is entitled A Halo of Blackness. This chapter occurs from Rand's point of view, and we open seeing Rand riding his gelding, Tainashar, through a gateway to Falma. It brings back memories of the time before when he followed Pat and Fane, the horn, and the ruby dagger here. It was at Falma where Rand first acknowledged who he really is. He wears the new sword, which also reminds him of Falma. He's accompanied by Nynaeve, three wise ones, Corel, Narishma, and Flynn. Nin has stayed behind. He has the access key to the Chodan Call, so he is not worried about an attack. Rand tells Nynaeve that he killed a man, a blade master, for the first time here, because Varen had told him that he should not channel in Falma. Nynaeve says that because of that battle, he has earned the Heron Mark on his blade, but Rand says that he has not because there were no witnesses involved, as Matt and Heron were fighting elsewhere at the time. Rand's interactions with Luz Theron are becoming more problematic because when he sees a sighting, Luz Theron again struggles for control. The day before, when Rand woke up, he awoke crying for his Ilyena, his lost Ilyena. His eyesight is slowly getting better, though. They are approaching the pavilion where the Daughter of the Nine Moons awaits.
So we're going to break for this point of view and continue in a moment with the second half of the chapter. This was kind of interesting. I mean, again, Rand's still just starting to carry that horribly dangerous vibe, and people are starting to recognize it in him. The note at the end of this this chapter summary states that there's further evidence that the sword that Rand is wearing is Justice, the sword of Archer Hawkwing. And for a while there, I struggled with trying to figure out exactly how Archer Hawkwing's sword would remind him of Falna until it occurred to me that Rand sees Hawkwing draw Justice.
Yeah.
When the heroes come back.
And he knows what it is.
There's a later reflection, too, that it was found under, maybe it was found under a statue, or it was found under, like, some excavation. Previous evidence on what this, or where this sword came from, that was supposed to be personal in nature to Rand, was that it could have been the High Lord Turok's sword, the one that he was using when Rand killed him here in Falma. But the only problem with that is, how would anyone have... Well, okay, first off, the building was never destroyed, so I have no idea why the sword would have been buried. And, you know, how anyone would have found it and thought to have given it to Rand seems really unlikely, so I do not know.
You kind of confused me there. Were you saying that... Well, that broke up a little bit. Were you saying that you thought that Turok had Justice?
No.
Oh, no.
I was saying that Turok had a Blade Master sword.
Right.
And, you know, during their battle, no one took the sword. The servants of Turok killed themselves, and the sword was left laying there.
Oh, that's right.
And originally, I want to say it was in an interview or just a question at a book signing that Brandon had answered, someone had made the suggestion that the sword that Rand now wears might be Turok's from Falma, which would be why it had such a connection to Rand. And, Brandon said that that was a legitimate possibility. So I had always assumed that that was that sword, but later evidence suggests that, you know, the sword had been buried and it had been uncovered in some sort of excavation. And, you know, why any of that would pertain to Turok's blade, we have no idea. So I don't know what side to come down on what this sword actually is. If it is Archer Hawkwing's blade, I'm relatively surprised, just because, again, it seems like that would have been interred in some sort of, you know, tomb to Hawkwing, which itself is probably lost now.
It seems like it would have been, and well, but then again, you know, these are basically the last days, and Carmen Guyan is approaching. Rand is one of the most strong Tavirin since Archer Hawkwing, and it's been said specifically by Moraine, I believe, that, you know, Tavirin draw what they need to them, and if there is some reason that Rand needs to be carrying Justice, Archer Hawkwing's sword, which if he recognized it, certainly could have been because he saw Hawkwing with it at Falma and recognized it then because the legend names the sword as Justice, and he thought to himself, you know, there is Archer Hawkwing with this legendary sword Justice. So it's probably true, and I think it's also interesting and possibly indicative of further twistiness that Brandon gives a typically Aes Sedai answer. Well, that's a legitimate possibility. It's not true, but it's a legit possibility.
Yeah.
You know, we can expect just more and more of this until the last book. It's just a little bit like our interview with Alan and Maria. You know, everything is read and find out, because you can't talk about anything without reviewing something else. It's so intertwined and convoluted. I mean, this whole book is like some massive weave of the power. You can't just pick out one thread without the whole thing imploding on you, if you'll pardon me, you know, a little bit of the illusion there.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't really touch on it in this chapter summary, but Rand does think that the reason Min has stayed behind on this trip is that, you know, that she is now afraid of him. Since under Semirog's control, he tried to kill her. It actually isn't the case, as we'll find out later. Min has her own reasons for deciding to stay behind, and while they are tied to the incident with Semirog, they are not the reasons that Rand thinks. Kind of, once again, hearkening back to old Rand, where, you know, everybody is thinking something, somebody else is thinking something else, and turns out that they're thinking the exact opposite. You know, it's always been one of those things. It was a nice touch back towards original Rand without ever going anywhere near making Rand as he was.
Rand's always had an incredible, nearly a talent for misapprehending what other people are thinking. I'm going to make a totally divergent aside to the very first opening scene of this thing, where I rather heavily emphasize the gelding tied Ashar, because I'm going to get back on my favorite horse here. There were a couple of places in this book where Tynasar was a gelding, the big black gelding that he acquired from Karuna after 12. And Tynasar has always been a gelding, except in The Gathering Storm, where it was just a mistake and they're going to fix it probably in later editions. He magically became a stallion again, which, I have just, being a horse person, I always thought was hysterically funny and probably more significant to me than 99% of the other readers. So Tynasar is in fact a gelding and will stay a gelding. It was just an oopsie. Which was only a horse fanatic would have ever caught in the first place, and probably no one ever cares. So there, I'm going to now dismount from my favorite pet hobby horse and back to reality here.
We also get reference in this chapter, of course, to Rand's eyesight. We tend to forget that Rand is probably almost close to being, you know, legally blind at this point. Just the flash burn damage from the fireball that took off his hand, you know, has really, really messed with his eyesight. And, you know, it's getting better, as one would expect this sort of damage to get better over time. But, yeah, Rand's, it is kind of significant that we've got that coupled with Rand's continued struggle with Luz Theron in his head, and just the sort of slipping further into insanity. You know, Semirog had warned how bad this could be, and, you know, we're getting further evidence that, again, that Rand's just, you know, his mindset is as such that he has this separate other personality who's, you know, capable of affecting him if he's not very careful. You know, the entire idea that, you know, Rand has channeled, or rather, Luz Theron has channeled weaves through Rand, and, you know, and attempted to do things on his own that Rand does not desire. And it's all this kind of culmination of Rand slowly slipping from the place where he can be effective at all.
Yeah, and that it also, to me, is indicative that I've always thought that Luz Theron was more than just a voice in his head, more than just a fragment of his personality, because, I'm sorry, personality fragments are not capable of coming up with knowledge unknown to the other personality. They may be split off in true schizophrenia, but they only have the knowledge and experience of the people that they are split off from. Whereas we have seen time and time again, Rand has acquired actual new knowledge from Luz Theron. He's learned weaves. Luz Theron has actually taken control of him when he sees Cider at, when he sees Cider at the manor house outside of Tyr in the Battle with the Trollocs. And Rand learned three new weaves from him: the Blossoms of Fire, Death Gates, and, I forgot the other one. But actually learned weaves that he did not know. I believe that's also where he originally came up with that construct that killed the Trollocs in the Stone of Cheer, way, way back when. So, I mean, It just seems very, very unlikely to me that Luthier is just a figment of his imagination. There's something more there, and I'm not sure if the resolution of this is ever going to really satisfy me, but here we go. I think it's also the eyesight thing. He's never actually worn the bandage over his eyes, because Rand is obviously, you know, the Fisher King is brought up in this book as part of the ancient game of Shara, and the Fisher King is, according to Morden's reflection, always worked as a man with wounds in his side and a bandage over his eyes, you know, the wounded king, you know, of our legend in our days. The Fisher King is actually a legend in and of itself in our mythology, and the Aes Sedai is always a key, you know, it's always a key. So what's what I'm looking for? Attribute. You know, the damaged Aes Sedai is always a key attribute of this particular legendary character, usually frequently the blind king. So it's just, it's all part of the, you know, ongoing tie-ins that we see toward very many different myths and legends that are from different cultures that we see wrapped around Rand. I don't know where I was going with that. Sorry, I sort of lost my train of thought while I was talking. So we should move on. Are you reading the next point of view, or am I?
No, it should be you.
So moving on to the next point of view in this chapter, we see Tuon, who is now meeting with Rand, and she is surprised at Rand's youth, but then Arthur Hoffman was young when he began his crusade for greatness. Rand has Marith Damani with him, and that makes her nervous, despite her time with Nat. In Shanchan, Ashaman are known as Sorvande Doom, Black-Souled Tempest. Kareed and the Deathwatch guards grow tense as the party approaches. She gestures to Seleucia to tell them to stay calm. Captain Lysenji has archers ready on a nearby rooftop. Tuon has not yet declared herself empress, so she can meet with the Dragonborn as a near equal. Malai had a foretelling of no rain, yet there is lightning in the sky. Rand sits and demands peace. The last battle is coming, and all forces will be needed to fight against the Shadow. In Tuon's mind, the battle will be between the Empire and the Shadow, with the Dragon Reborn as a tool against Light Eater. She is surprised that he is not blinded yet. Recalling Kylie's report on the Trolloc, she thinks that Rand may be right about the last battle being close, and she wonders if he blames her for the loss of his hand, as Valendre describes. Tuon suggests unity by having Rand's people take the oath, but Rand cuts her off, saying he will not let anyone be leashed. She tries to catch him off guard by bringing up Matt. Rand remembers seeing her with him in his visions, but Tuon thinks that this must be the madness. She asks what Matt is really like. He seemed a bit of a scoundrel. One of the Marith Damani then angrily defends Matt, and Tuon is impressed with the loyalty that they show to him. Rand leans forward and exerts all of his will on her. A dark halo surrounds him. Suddenly, she is willing to give him anything he wants, but she fights it off with her strength of will and refuses peace. She cannot ally with such a monster. Rand stands and leaves. After she recovers her composure, she stands and announces that she is now the Empress. As celebration begins, she quietly tells General Galgun to tell General Yulon to prepare his strike against the White Tower immediately. I think one of the notes in this chapter right off the bat is pretty significant, which mentions something that struck me immediately as well, which is that Rand's severe effect on the pattern has changed since he touched the true power, and it seems to be pretty much all negative now. I guess this brings up the question as to whether Tuon's failure to respond to his Taviran tugging is purely her strength of will, or has Rand's touch on the true power reduced the ability of the pattern to weave as it chooses. And apparently at a book signing, Brandon Sanderson stated that this was Tuon's willpower. We know that she is extremely strong will. Exerting all of his will against her is pretty impressive. And you can see the strength of Rand's Taviran-ness and his ability to basically pull the pattern around him. She actually sees the dark halo around him. I mean, that's the second person that we've seen see that. I believe Cadswain was the first. Has Nynaeve seen the dark halo?
I don't remember if she has or not.
No, I don't think she has. I think it's basically Cadswain and Tuon, which is kind of interesting when you think about it, because aren't those two of the strongest-willed characters in the entire book?
Theoretically.
Yeah. Well, two of the most stubborn, surely.
Yeah, there is also a note at Tuon's surprise that Rand has not been blinded yet. And they note here that this is probably a misinterpretation of a passage in the Asonic cycle, the Shanchan version of the prophecies of the dragon. And
well, go ahead,
we ultimately come to a similar conclusion, I think, by the end of the novel, where we actually get that portion of the Asonic cycle. It is interesting to me how, I mean, you mentioned, Virginia, that Tuon is extremely stubborn. Just how focus everything is towards, you know, on this side of the ocean, it's the Dragon Reborn who has to be fighting the Dark One, and everybody is, you know, everyone has to follow the Dragon Reborn, and, you know, in the Empire, it's all, you know, the Empire, and it becomes centered around, you know, the Empress and the forces of the Empire being the ones who are actually fighting the last battle, and not really certain how much of that is just the development of the prophecies of the dragon in Shanshan over, you know, the 3,000, well, not 3,000, but over the extremely long period of time that they've been separated from the main continent, and how much of it is Ishamiel's tinkering with what has been written.
He's a great one for tinkering, that Ishamiel. He was basically everywhere, not only the known world, but apparently Shanshan as well. Pretty impressive when you think about it, considering he was not completely free for all those centuries, millennia, really. I keep coming back to this dark halo that's surrounding Rand. Do you think that that is an offshoot of his increasing interior darkness, or is that strictly a result of his having touched the true power? Do we see that dark halo around Morden, who is basically the person who has touched the true power the most?
I don't believe so, but then again, I don't recall either. I honestly think it's probably a facet of both of them. It's just the combination that Rand's Taveren nature is growing stronger and is growing more destructive, which, you know, it's been noted in previous chapters, and I think is noted in later chapters, is actually rather disconcerting, because the concept of balance that the wheel is striving for is not working the way they should around Rand. We don't know if that is a product that they need, or the wheel needs more destruction now than it does balance, or whether, you know, something has caused Rand's Taveren nature to shift into something that is not productive at all.
I guess that brings to my mind the question of the nature of Taveren. I mean, we have pretty much through history only seen Taveren as forces for the light. Are there dark Taveren as well? I mean, I don't call any mention of them, and it makes me wonder if this is a function of the wheel and the pattern trying to bring balance back on the force of the light, because as we've seen throughout the history that we know, the forces of the dark basically seem to be much stronger than those of the light at all times. If Rand making himself so hard and basically almost evil in an Eridol sort of way is bending the pattern so far out of kilter because he is so strongly Taveren, and he's not supposed to be almost evil because he's so hard. When I come to that, the dark halo, and it makes me wonder actually if at this point in time Rand wasn't closer to becoming the Dark One's champion than at any time ever. And I wondered why Morden hasn't stepped in and tried to, you know, convert him. I could kind of see Rand doing an inquiry on him. In other words, in order to save the world, you have to sacrifice yourself to the dark. I mean, I think at the same time Rand would almost do that. I mean, he's always protested it. I'll never join you, you know, and we'll look Skywalker a certain way. I'll never turn to the dark side. But I think he could seriously be convinced that that's the only way to save Amos and everyone in the world without breaking, he probably would do it.
Yeah.
That would be a kind of death for him, in a way. You know, and he knows that the living must die. Well, I think it's interesting that Tuan perceives him as a monster, too. Of course, she has a built-in, you know, prejudice against any male channelers, or any channelers at all, for that matter, but the fact that she sees this dark halo surrounding him has certainly, you know, pushed her even farther toward that corner.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in a way, Rand sort of disabuses her here again. Which, like I said, I'm surprised a little bit by the Shanshan naivete. I mean, he really does kind of, he's just like, no, you're going to listen to me. I'm the Dragon Reborn. This is the way it works. This is how the last battle is going to go. And, you know, just, he does. He completely, you know, ignores pretty much everything about her. Because, you know, for him, she's just another noble, and it all comes down to, if she were not as strongly willed, then, you know, things could have gone a lot differently, and who knows what would have ended up happening. I kind of have a feeling that her being able to exert her willpower might also be, you know, a sort of effect of the pattern. You know, they need her to be, you know, the pattern needs her to be strong and needs her to not assent to the wishes of the Dragon Reborn. And so she doesn't. And, you know, we keep saying that Rand's Taveren nature is making, you know, things happen the way he wants them now, but I wonder a little bit how much we can trust that. You know, maybe the pattern is just working in a slightly different way around it, and yes, the most overt effects of the Taverenness are being displayed, but that, you know, the pattern is still following its natural course. You know, Tuan naturally would be disinclined to agree with him. And, you know, it does say that it took, like, every scrap of her willpower to be able to say no to him. Because she was aware that everything was saying that she wanted to say yes. She wanted to agree. And, you know, it seems very fortuitous that, you know, she was able to, summon the strength to do what she needed to do.
But this meeting was almost doomed to fail from the beginning because, as you said, Rand just sees her as another noble that he needs to bring onto his side, and she sees him as a tool. Obviously, their prophecies say that the Empress is going to be the one who defeats the Shadow, those who serve the Shadow, and then she sends the Dragon Reborn in to duel with Light Eater like a hunter sending off a hound, you know, on the chase.
Yeah.
They're worlds apart there. I mean, they're both obviously strong-willed people, as we've mentioned, and neither one of them is likely to budge an inch. So I just, you know, even though they're both exerting he his Taveren nature and she her willpower, it was a draw. So he stalked off and she withdrew, and now he can't make an alliance with the Shanchen. I mean, that's a lot of swords and a lot of Sulgam and Damani that he could really use. And again, like I say, the Shanchen Naefte, Tuan doesn't even see what she's lost. She doesn't even get it at all. I mean, she just doesn't get it. I wonder if Nat is going to be instrumental in bringing her to fight with Rand than trying to control him during the last battle. I mean, he hasn't shown that he's had a lot of influence with her so far, but maybe that will change as time goes on, if they ever actually get to, you know, get back together and resume their relationship.
Yeah. So we will move on then to Chapter 36, The Death of Tuan. Yes, you heard me correctly, the death of Tuan. Our actual first point of view is not from Tuan's point of view. Rather, it is from Matt. Varen tells Matt Tomanis and Mondavwin her story and how she is consistently unable to get to the White Tower for various reasons, and that she eventually determined that it is in fact Matt's Taveren nature that was holding her in place until he could get to her. She was with Rand in Tyr, and she tells Matt that Rand has cleansed the taint on Sidene. She left Tyr to go to Tar Valon, but something always prevented her from staying in one spot long enough to learn the new location for traveling. She and Thomas finally caught a ride with a merchant going to Kyrian, but they fell asleep, and when they awoke, he had changed directions, going for Murindi instead of Kyrian. Finally, she tries skimming, but Thomas mentions a trip to Trustair at the exact moment that Varen cast the weaving, and that is... And Trustair is where they eventually wind up. Varen eventually gives up trying, knowing that the pattern is forcing her towards either Matt or Perrin, since she has just left Rand. She uses the pictures that were given to her by a dark friend who wants to find Matt, or who wants Matt and Perrin dead. She warns him to be very careful. She offers Matt a bargain, and that she will take him and the band, the Red Hand, to Camelin, if he will promise to follow instructions in a sealed letter. He sees that she has several similar letters in her pouch and refuses. She then offers him a different deal. He must stay in Camelin for 50 days. They compromise eventually on 30, and she gives him a sealed letter in case that he changes his mind, which he stoutly professes that he will not. He wonders if Elaine is there and if she will help him get started on Ludra's dragons. He will also need time to learn all he can about the Tower of Genji. She does not think that Tom will complain about the time. Varen takes a flower brooch and they begin to break camp. Interesting thing in this point of view. It's not actually mentioned here. This is one of my favorite mat sequences so far in the book, mainly because of the infamous devil bench. Varen takes the only chair in Matt's smaller audience tent, and you know, in the process, Matt is forced to sit on this pillowed bench, which we've still not really identified where the bench came from, but it was just Matt is thoroughly uncomfortable through the entire chapter, constantly shifting on this bench, and he thinks to himself at how horrible he has to look, you know, shifting and fidgeting through this entire thing while Varen is sitting there all calm, and it really puts a bug under his bonnet, you know, for lack of a better phrase. But at the very beginning, I mean, from the very start of the chapter, you know, well, then how did you end up here? Matt asked, still suspicious as he seated himself on that pillowed bench. He hated the thing. It was completely impossible to sit on in any way that was comfortable. Pillows didn't seem to help. Somehow they made the seat more awkward. Bloody thing must have been designed by an insane cross-eyed Trolloc and built from the bones of the damned. That was the only reasonable explanation. By the end of the chapter, Matt has orders people to have the bench burned. And I've toyed with the notion that maybe Matt's discomfort on the bench was Varen actually doing something. Until it occurred to me that Matt would still be wearing his necklace, and so therefore I don't know how she would be able to cast a weave that would make him uncomfortable unless, you know, it somehow infected the whole environment, and how she would be specific enough to be able to affect just the bench that he is sitting on is, it seems a little too suspicious for me.
I don't know, but I think it's possible for her to cast a weave on the bench, even though she can't touch him, even though he's touching it. I don't think the effect of the triangle that he wears would necessarily communicate itself to everything in contact with him. I think it's just him. But I don't know, I could be wrong. But I do think it's kind of funny because later on, Matt actually refers to it in his mind as the devil bench. Shifting on the devil bench again. So I think he kind of hated this thing beforehand, so it may be that it was just a really disgusting, bad bench. But I personally have a hard time seeing how, and there are only so many ways you can make a bench. How in the world do you make it so that it's completely impossible to sit on it in any way that's comfortable? I think that would be harder to make than a right one. But then I've always kind of had problems with some of the furniture in the Wheel of Time here. It absolutely drove me crazy with the Salador Aes Sedai. I mean, here's Egwene, the Amelin seat, sitting on a stool that folds up all the time. Here's Swan, sitting on a stool, no two legs of which were the same. Good God, people. They're surrounded by warders. Some of them have got to be handy with a saw and a file. They're surrounded by soldiers. Some of them must be able to even up the legs on a bench. And they're putting up with this like it's some impossible circumstance that can't be cured. It's like, hello? I could have done that myself. He could have leaven those legs on the stool up with the wind power for crying out loud. I was constantly amazed and annoyed by that. You know, just amazed and annoyed. I could have fixed it myself. Like, I'm not that handy. I expect better out of Aes Sedai and warders for crying out loud.
Yeah, this is true. There's also been a lot of conjecture in this chapter over what specifically the instructions are that Varen is entrusting to Matt. Our biggest assumption is that Varen has revealed to Matt where the Horn of Valyr is, and that they will, and that Matt's instructions will be, hey, last battle's coming, you may want to go and get this, since you're the only guy who can use it, we think.
unless you die.
Yeah, so there is that. I'm trying to figure out here, because later incidents with Varen will set a time limit on her being able to perform certain actions. And so I don't actually possibly wonder if these actions, that if these actions are not in some way counter to what we think they might be. This is extremely hard because obviously what I have to say contains spoilers from a later chapter in the book. That Varen's instructions could possibly be dubious in their benefit to Matt is not unquestionable at this point. Now, we can actually wonder whether or not these are coming from Varen and are from Varen and are for Matt and hence Wise-Ran's own good, or whether it is, you know, whether it's a ruse, whether it's a lead off into something else. We're going to have to wait, obviously, until Towers of Midnight in order to hopefully find out. I'm severely praying we don't have to wait until a memory of light to find out what's in Varen's letters. I mean, it took us from... Took us from Fires of Heaven, clear up until Knife of Dreams to find out what was in Moraine's letter to Tom. So hopefully we won't have to wait much longer than this next book to find out what these instructions are and learn their importance. As Matt does note, there are also... Oops, sorry.
It won't take us that long. We don't have 6 more books to go, so...
That's true. One of the other things is that we do note that Matt does notice that there were multiple other letters. And, you know, who are these letters for? You know, obviously I'm going to guess that at least one of them contained instructions on if Varen encountered Perrin instead of Matt. Because, you know, Varen would have no way of knowing which of the two boys was pulling her to him. But, you know, it seemed like there were a lot of letters. So, you know... Who else does Varen end up giving instructions to before the end of the book? And I guess this is something else we're going to have to wait until a memory, or not, until Towers of Midnight for.
We can find out my favorite words. So it's interesting that she didn't have anything else for anybody with Matt. You know, I would have thought that Tom might be somehow significant, but perhaps Varen doesn't know. How would she know about the impending visit to the Tower of Genji?
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, what would we assume would be in these letters, instructions that would be significant for people who are going to be, you know, crucial to the last battle? Obviously, Matt's one, Perrin's another. But it's a packet of letters. There must have been a lot more. Actually, I believe it's Matt Hatch told us that Drannan has mentioned several times at signings that he's really surprised that people aren't doing more speculation on what was involved in those letters. I don't know. I don't get a lot of things that I should get. I did not. I've read through the books again, and I still don't know what the small detail that's mentioned in books 4 through 6 is that's going to be significant. I can't figure out what it is. Guess I'm just dumb. Here's another interesting thing. This is the first time that we've seen... another interesting thing, this is the first time in this chapter we've seen Sidar used as a verb.
Yes.
Matt accuses Varen of Sidar, having Sidar'd it. Sidar'd it?
And I love that Varen gives him a rather quirkish look at the terminology. The deal that they eventually strike on is interesting. I don't know if it's just that Varen realized that Matt would have to haggle at her in order to get the number of days she actually wanted Matt to stay in Camelin. She had to, you know, put a higher number out there first, or, you know, I'm actually kind of wondering as to, you know, number one, why the need for a delay. I mean, obviously I'm guessing Varen has a contingency plan. If Matt just won't accept her instructions, that, you know, she can find a way to influence events that will then, you know, kind of push Matt into doing what she wants, even without him opening the letter and reading the directions. But yeah, I'm not exactly 100% certain what she's getting at. It does make a mention here at the end of the chapter notes that by waiting 30 days, Matt will be free to leave Camelin very shortly after Varen arrives in Tarvalon. And I wonder if, you know, that is significant. Obviously, Varen has a particular plan in mind as she goes to the White Tower. And, you know, the waiting 30 days, putting her just past being in Tarvalon, seems extremely significant. So I am not 100% certain why there's that particular delay, but the timing seems very, very structured. It doesn't seem to me, and actually to the people at Encyclopedia Watt, that sort of timing could just be mere happenstance.
It is kind of strange because she mentions that Matt asks her, and Varen asks if they have a compromise, and Matt asks if he'll tell her, if she'll tell him what's in that bloody paper, and she says no, because I might not need you to go through with the contents. I hope to be able to return to you and relieve you of the letter and send you on your way. But if I cannot, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly, in foreshadowing what's happening in another chapter, that event wasn't carved in stone, or the timing of it wasn't carved in stone. And furthermore, I think that her arrival in the White Tower mere moments before a crucial event was highly coincidental, if not significant. I just kind of surprised by that, really. But she had several different plans, not all of which resulted in what actually happened. Trying not to spoil here.
Yeah.
Trying really hard. No, I don't know. You have anything else on Varen? I'm kind of...
No, I do like that this will set us up for at least one Matt chapter in Camelin. I mean, he's going to be there for about a month, roughly, a little more or less in the Wheel of Time calendar, but yeah, we will have a good chunk of time where Matt is in Camelin, and I'm guessing that we're probably going to get some interaction with Elaine during that time. I for the life of me cannot imagine that Matt is going to manage to completely avoid going to the Royal Palace at all during any point in time that he's in Camelin. You know, Elaine having probably just solidified her throne, and, you know, and actually in the business of running the country. And, you know, I don't see Matt popping in and being like, hey, Basil Gill, how about, oh wait, you're not Basil Gill. Hey, person who's running the inn for Basil Gill, how about offering me a room since I know him? Yeah, and I'm probably not going to happen that way. So, you know, that at least gives us, you know, a direct line towards, you know, the production of the dragons and various other things that will be going on that could be really interesting once Towers of Midnight hit.
Yeah, I don't know if I can wait. I know it's not that many days away, but it still seems all too long. Anyway, we leave Matt with his point of view telling somebody to burn that bloody bench. I can't believe we carted the thing this far. And thus passes the devil bench. This is actually, I really need to go back and read this again because it's really kind of a cool chapter. We get a lot of insights into Matt and Varen here. It's just cute. I really like it. The interaction. We don't see that much interaction between Matt and Varen, and this was kind of fun. So moving on, we go to Tuan's point of view. It is now a few days since her meeting with the Dragon Reborn, and she has taken a new name as Empress, or Tuana. She gives her blessing to the five Blood Knives who will go on the Tarvalon raid. Blood Knives wear special Tarangreal rings activated by their own blood. The rings give them extra stamina and speed, but also kill them in a few days. Otuana personally donated a Demonian soul Domdali and Malhavana to the raid. Hundreds of Rakan and Tilrakan prepare for flight. It is now early evening, and Lieutenant General Yulon will personally lead the raid, traveling only at night for secrecy, the flight to Tarvalon will take several days. Otuana tells Seleucia that General Galdan is wrong, that this will not weaken the Dragon Reborn. It will turn him against them. Seleucia asks if that was not already the case, and Otuana replies, no, we were against him. They will see how big a difference that is.
Personally, I'm sad to see Tuan go.
Yeah, I don't like Fortuana's name nearly as well. It's a little too cute for me.
Well, I mean, it contains her old name, which is, I guess, something, but at the same time, it just, I don't know. And I also, it comes down with that same idea. I guess I'm too much like the people of the main continent, wherein, you know, just because someone says their name is something else completely, you know, Aegeonin is still Aegeonin and not Leelwyn. You know, with her, I can kind of make a slight exception, but, you know, it's just, one's shorter, it's easier, sounds better. You know, and at this point, you know, if I'm going to have to refer to her as something other than Tuan, I'm just going to say the Empress, because, I mean, that's what she is.
The Empress makes you live forever.
I liked the introduction of the blood knives and explaining what actually happens, or how they are able. I mean, because these, you know, when in an earlier chapter in Hinderstaff we said, you know, wow, we didn't ever think we'd get zombies in the Wheel of Time and that. Look, now we get ninjas in the Wheel of Time. But no, I mean, the blood knives are able to use the ring, yes, partially for concealment in the shadows, which I thought was extremely interesting, considering at how closely that comes to, you know, possibly having a tie towards the Murdral. But also, yes, the increased speed and stamina just makes them a vicious assassin. It's just that in order to do so, you know they're not coming back. Activating the ring pretty much kills them. We'll see them come into play during the Tarvalon raid.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. Just as an aside, I thought it's kind of interesting that there must be somebody in Shanshan that can make these Tarangriel as well as the Idom, because, I mean, here we have all the Aes Sedai in Randland, you know, postulating that there are no two Tarangriel the same that perform the same function. They just had never found any that perform the same function. Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, they had the hugest collection, they had the largest collection of, you know, objects with the power of anyone, and they had all studied, you know, those that they could get their hands on in other places, and of all the they even disparaged the idea of the existence of the Shanshan item because of that very thing. Sometimes I said I was so stubborn. You know, and here over in Shandar and Shanshan, they've got, you know, baskets of the same kind of things just laying around. Somebody must be making them.
This is true.
They have Tarangriel factories, manufacturing, or it's just like they have just a few Damani, you know, closeted away in their little rooms, churning out Tarangriel and Idom, you know, blood knife rings, who knows what else.
They say as much in the Great Hunt when Egwene is discovered to be able to detect metals and then detect that she has a strong affinity with Earth. You know, they mention that, you know, well, you're too valuable now, and if you're able to work, you know, Tarangriel, you'll have a special place. There'll be no blowing stuff up for you. So, you know, it does seem that, you know, any one of them that they find that has ability to work with Tarangriel, you know, is immediately just going to be put into use as a production.
Yeah. Interesting, though. I wonder if they gather them together in huge, you know, manufactories and sitting there at their little benches churning them out, or do they each individually make them in their own little things? Is that all they ever do? Are they pretty much... I mean, obviously they're not going to have them in battle, blowing stuff up, as they said, but it just makes me wonder. I guess it's a pretty good thing that they didn't capture Elaine, too, because clearly she has the ability to make Tarangriel.
Yep.
I think how different things would have been if they'd have collared Elaine, too.
Well, obviously the entire rescue of Egwene would have been severely complicated.
Another little interesting thing here, when they're getting ready for the attack on the White Tower, hundreds of Tarakan milled in the pens behind them, walked by their handlers preparing. Where did they get hundreds of Tarakan over here? Have they just been, I mean, they didn't fly them over here. They came on ship. It's too long of a flight for Tarakan. And have they just been nonstop ferrying troops and Rakan and Tarakan back and forth? I thought some of these, you know, Shanshan exotics, they tripped very well and died.
I don't know. I mean, we also don't really know what their gestation cycle is. Not that I can imagine, you know, you'd be able to breed, hatch, grow, and train you know, to Rockin in under 2 years, but I don't know. I mean, I'm going to guess that they've probably had further reinforcements. Initially, there weren't very many because obviously the Regal didn't carry, very much. They carried enough to be able to establish a foothold, but I'm guessing a lot more came through with the Karen. And then, you know, after that, I cannot imagine that there has been no communication with Shanshan. It's just that, you know, it's probably slower in coming and not really needed to be mentioned that there was just more arriving. But the Karen itself was extremely large. I mean, they mentioned that. They clogged seaports all over the place, bringing people in. And,
yeah, with wagons and flocks and herds and clans.
Yeah.
Everything, the forges, everything they needed to set up. So, yeah. But all of, I'm just kind of surprised me. Hundreds of Chirakan and flocks of Rakan circling overhead. Wow. That's, I wouldn't think you could fit too many of those on the ship. But there you go. It's not like you can stack them up in the hold. You know, you gotta have, I mean, they'd be like aircraft carriers for these Chirakan.
Yeah, I'm not exactly certain. I mean, maybe one of the functions of having the ribbed rigging is so that, you know, the Turrican can just kind of hang out.
Perch in the rigging?
Maybe those aren't actually sails. Maybe the Turrican just kind of open their wings up and...
yeah, I don't
hold
know.
Hold on.
Oh, that's really weird. What does it matter if people in Ebedar said, saw hundreds of Turrican take to the sky? Wow. I mean, that would actually be a sight.
Yeah.
A real sight to see. I don't think I really want to see it. Turrican with Damani and Sildam on their backs attacking from the air. It could be the beginning of a bold new tactic, or it could lead to a disaster. Well, we think we know where that went. They changed everything, but I don't think it was the way they wanted it to be.
Well, I mean, ultimately, the air raid idea is a very good one. It's just their target was kind of poorly chosen.
And the target was a little tougher than they thought. Well, what do we think was going to happen? I mean, you know, hundreds of Aes Sedai just going to sit there quietly while they bombard the tower and collar them? You know, what did they think?
Actually, kind of, yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, as we'll see later, and that it takes very special circumstances in order to deal with this future air raid. But that will be saved for another episode.
So we're going to move on to chapter 37, which is entitled A Force of Light. This one is from Min's point of view. And we see Rand preparing for his attack on Natrin Sparrow as Min watches. She used to see herself as a last defense for Rand, but after she failed him twice with Semirag and was used as a tool against him, she now sees herself as more of a liability. His peace with the Shanshan failed, so now he will abandon Narad-Dhaman and move forward to the last battle. Min has a new viewing. Dragonmount is cloaked in dark shadows as if shaded by clouds high above, with a tiny prick of light shining from the heavens down onto the point of the mountain. She asks if Rand has considered that the boy might have been a trap. He says no. Mogedion might set a trap like that, but not Grendel. Rand has a sword and the access key for the Chonon Call. He sends for 20 maidens, led by Nandira, and Nynaeve and Lord Ramshalon. Min worries that he has not planned this out sufficiently. He has spent months maneuvering somewhere else after all, and now this is going very quickly. Rand describes Natrin Sparrow. It was once a fortress to watch the mountains of mist and a retreat for Domani kings, but it has not been used in many years. King Al-Salam probably did not even know about it. Ramshalon and Nynaeve arrive, and Rand tells Ramshalon that he is to be the negotiator. Min worries that he will flip like he did with Milisar. Grendel will not be goaded like Robin or Samael, Rand thinks. Rand says, remember what happened to Taurus Margan. Rand then opens a gateway to a hilltop near Natrin Sparrow and sends Ramshalon on his way to negotiate with the owner. In a couple of hours, he returns, reporting that the owner is pleasant and wishes to cooperate. Rand's command, Nynaeve delves him and learns that he is indeed under compulsion. Min tells him that he should ask for advice before acting rashly, perhaps ask Cadswain. Rand says Cadswain held him in a box. Kalendor is another box requiring a circle to be used safely. He was angry when he used Kalendor, and he must be unemotional. He must kill with purpose, as when he killed Leah at Shadar Logoth. We then see the access key glows, and he balefires all of Natrin's Barrow. Min and Nynaeve are horrified that he has callously murdered dozens of people, but Rand calls it a mercy. Nynaeve delves Ramshalon again. The compulsion is gone, proving that Grendel is dead. Man then turns to Romshalon. He knows of his bragging to Lords Vivian and Calswell, and he exiles him. The others return to the mansion in Vanderabon. Nynaeve wishes Moraine were here. She thinks that Cadswain is right. No one person can handle Rand. Nynaeve and Min head for the cottage where Cadswain is staying, and they pass Olivia on the way. Maurice, Cadswain, Amys, there, Melaine, and Sorin are there. Nynaeve relates what happens, and she says that she wants to be a part of their plan, and Cadswain will give her a chance if she can be obedient. Cadswain thinks Nynaeve may be salvageable, and Amys adds that Egwene also has great honor. Cadswain gives Nynaeve an assignment to find Perrin Abara. Rand may know where he is, but she'll have to get that information out of him. Min thinks her job is to get Rand to the last battle alive and sane with his soul intact.
Wow.
Well, they just sort of, and the notes sort of brushed past one of the key scenes in the entire book, the hail firing of Nathan Sparrow and presumably destruction of Grendel. I mean, that's the equivalent of a nuclear strike, and this guy just absolutely dropped the bomb on Grendel, he thinks, and he's pretty sure, with the proofs, that he's killed her once and for all. And again, with Semerog, he killed a woman, but it was in self-defense. Basically, she was trying to kill Min. I mean, not really self-defense, but in defense of his loved one. And this time, he just basically planned, plotted, and executed Grendel. The darkness is now pretty much complete.
Yeah, this entire chapter, and first off, we get the reappearance of Romshalon in this, you know, complete and total useless sycophant. And, you know, honestly, Rand had an amazingly really good idea with him and, you know, ultimately banishes him afterwards. But I mean, you know, just the idea of let's send him in. Grendel will appreciate that he's pretty and, you know, will, you know, think that she can use him as a kind of pawn thing. But, you know, she doesn't know that for me, that things have changed. I am interested that, you know, that we do get another vision of Min, this entire, you know, Dragonmount cloaked in the shadows, the small pinprick of light shining on the heavens down onto the mountain. This is actually, you know, there are two parts of things. I mean, one, it's kind of reflecting the omnipresent cloud cover that has pervaded this book and, you know, the darkness, which is kind of lying over the land. And, you know, it kind of foretells everything is coming a lot quicker because we will end up seeing the resolution of this vision by the end of the book. I wonder how much Rand is relying on memories of Luthien, because I mean, he mentions that, you know, Magetti and Mito set a trap, like having the boy there on purpose, but Grendel's not that subtle, but Rand does, you know, consistently kind of bring up this point that, you know, yeah, Grendel really isn't. She's out there and she's very, very noticeable always. And I don't know how much of that is just what he assumes he knows from Luthien, or how much, you know, he is taken into account that, you know, Rand's, the Forsaken are what they appear to be. Because we know that Grendel, well, yes, she's maybe isn't as subtle as Mogedion. She also isn't stupid. She does have a lot of really intense plans. And I know Virginia is a very strong proponent of this. There is a growing segment of the Wheel of Time community who are not exactly 100% certain that Grendel is dead. You know, the compulsion is gone, but we don't necessarily know that wasn't supposed to be time delayed. Grendel might have expected that, you know, well, maybe in sending this person to me, acknowledging that I'm here is just a precursor to check whether or not I am here and launch some sort of attack. You know, it very well could be that she purposefully set the weave to unravel under certain conditions, but I don't know. I don't know what's possible, and I guess we'll end up having to read on and find out. You know, we may see more of Grendel yet. We may not. And, you know, I am not the one to say. They did mention in the notes after the chapter summary that the death of Grendel will come as a particular shock to a certain fan segment. Jordan and Sanderson had promised to resolve the murder of Asmodian in the final books, and a large contingent of people, I will admit, myself included, were under the distinct impression that Grandal was ultimately responsible for that death. Those who do believe that Grandal is guilty comment are basically left with two really difficult options. Either we're wrong, or there's going to have to be some extremely creative writing going on in order to make the disclosure with neither Asmodia nor Grandal available.
Oh, I don't know. You know, Rand is getting more and more devious, but I think that all of the Forsaken have just had so many more years of being sneaky, evil, and devious that I don't think he can compete with them. Plus, no matter what he's made out of himself lately, at heart, he's a good person, you know. And he didn't grow up in a royal court. You know, he didn't grow up like Elaine, you know, or not so much Elaine because Andor's not nearly as devious as Carian, but, you know, he just didn't grow up learning about plots and twists within twists and plots within plots. He's just not his nature. He's getting really good at it considering he's had, what, a couple of years to not only make the transition from a farm boy to a leader and a king, let alone the Dragon Reborn, but I mean, it's just not in his nature to be tricksy and cunning like, you know, Mulgideon, Semiraga, Grendel. So they're just gonna wrap him up and send him out to play. I mean, poor guy, he's really trying hard, but I don't think he's up to this task. They're just too tricksy. But I think what this has done to him, you know, as a person, is pretty much the last straw. I mean, the chapter with Semiraga was entitled The Last That Could Be Done, but this was really, as far as I'm concerned, the last that could be done to him. And I'm going to sort of transition back to the beginning where they're talking about Min's viewing, you know, and the ongoing mention of the overwhelming cloudiness and the dark clouds and the spooky silver and black clouds that come and go erratically and everything. And I really think this is all tied to that. Oh, I think it was in The Fires of Heaven where there's a writing. I don't think it was part of the prophecies, but it might have been, and I'm sorry I didn't look this up beforehand, but I didn't. But it goes on about the land is tied to the dragon, and the dragon is tied to the land. There can be no health in the land, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I really think that the land and the world, in a large part, is reflecting the darkness in Rand more and more. You know, we've seen all these atmospheric effects and so forth and so on increase as Rand has become darker and darker and closer to becoming evil himself in his quest to be hard enough to survive and do what he needs to do. And I'm almost wondering, I was just really struck with the thought we talked about reality unraveling earlier. I'm wondering how much of these things that are happening, the bubbles of evil and the, maybe not the bubbles of evil so much, but the dead walking and reality rippling and so forth, are actually not so much offshoots of the Dark One touching the world, but also partly offshoots of Rand basically dismantling the good man that he was to become this hard, cold killer. You know, he turned himself into a Randland-style Terminator, basically. Everything that he held to is pretty much gone now, except his destiny to fight the Dark One. Now, the last thing, his last rule, that he won't kill a woman, has just been broken over and over again. And the last time he did it, I mean, with Leia, he did it because he wanted to save her from agony. You know, with Semiraga, he did it to save Min. The last time he did it just because she needed killing. That's about as far down as this guy can get, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is. I said at the very beginning of this book that I didn't understand how Jason Denzel could tell us that, you know, Rand will go to a point lower than you possibly thought, like completely lower than you could have imagined him ever being able to go to. And by this chapter, you're like, wow, I was totally wrong. He can go lower. And at this point, you're thinking, he can't possibly get any worse. And as you'll see in future episodes, you're completely wrong again.
You know,
this is not the bottom. I am kind of impressed a little bit. There is, and I don't know if it was intentional, it probably wasn't, there is a kind of tacit nod to the musical Jekyll and Hyde in this chapter. And I don't know why, I was just, it just occurred to me as I was, you know, reading through the segments and that, you know, the description of Rand as he's destroying the Barrow, you know, it clicks with, you know, the line in the song, I Need to Know, where you're downed by some heavenly stigma yet blazing with light. And I mean, that's what Rand is. The Chosen Call is, you know, shining, you know, a beacon and, you know, everything. And, you know, here he is in the sheer act of committing an atrocity. You know, the chapter summary says dozens of people on that, but I have to imagine there's at least 100 people within, you know, a manor of that particular size.
Yeah.
And
men and women, both.
And here he is just, you know, wiping them all completely from existence so thoroughly that, I mean, he's, you know, and yet at the same time, they're mentioning that, you know, he's, you know, blazing like a force of the light itself, you mm-hmm. know, and connecting it to this, what we have come to think of as a holy power.
Yeah.
And it's just the extreme reversal of, you know, utilizing, you know, powerful force that we assume, you know, to be good for what essentially is a thoroughly despicable act.
Yeah, because he not only convinced himself to do for Grendel, but he didn't even care about the collateral damage. Like you say, hundreds of people, and any number of them might have been women, so he's just given up all of it. He's just given up. And did they actually say that he embraced Cydene to do this, or did he go back to the true power for this badness?
Well, I'm assuming since he's using the Chosen Call, he's using he's using Cydene. I mean,
yeah,
that's, I can't imagine that the access keys have that sort of mutability.
Yeah.
To be able to transfer between. Otherwise, you know, you could just have the male access key and be like, I'm going to use the female one if it were still working.
Right.
So.
Thank you. I totally missed that. I have to take a minute here and pat myself on the back. This is probably one of my better calls in trying to guess things that are going to happen in real time because I'm sure you will remember and I'm going to do it again. Back when we were doing the Knife of Dreams read through, I did a very bad job of singing it because I was so sick, but I basically did a little crossover to Dr. Horrible, and Rand basically woke up singing It's a Brand New Day and decided to go out and balefire Grendel, you know. It's a brand new day, all the birds are singing because you're going to die. And that's exactly what he did. He just woke up and said, by golly, today's the day I'm going to the dark side. With bells on. I said that really kind of jokingly and never, ever really believed that it would be as bad as it was. I kind of thought he might work himself up to a one-on-one, you know, like he did with Semeraug. He's attacked, he kills, you know, or like he did with Semeraug to save someone else. He'll kill a woman. I never, ever really thought that he would seriously just go out and plot this unbelievable act of nuclear deterrence on one of the Forsaken. The other thing is that I was going to bring up was there's a little side where Rand remembers what happened to Tors Morgan, and this is becoming just like Matt, really. He is having the same exact trouble that Matt is in distinguishing Lutheran's memories from his own. They've all blended together seamlessly. He doesn't even notice it anymore, just like Matt in the last chapter, the chapter before last. I think that's kind of interesting, and really the only one of the three boys who isn't getting that is Aaron. It bothers me on some level, and I can't really explain exactly why, but it surprised me that Rand is basically doing the same thing.
Well, and it just, you know, there are these horribly profound, you know, effects. You know, a lot of this chapter, we focus, of course, on Rand's actions at Natron's Burrow, but, you know, we forget that, you know, afterwards, Nynaeve is so thoroughly just concerned over what's happened that, you know, she and Min have to go and seek out Cad Swain and try to strike this deal because they recognize that the path Rand's on isn't going to lead to victory for the light, or if it is, it's the victory of the light might not be much better than the victory for the shadow. And of course, that leads us into Nynaeve's eventual assignment to find Perrin.
Yeah, I wonder why did she do that? Why does Cad Swain need her to find Perrin? That kind of, I gotta confess, I got nothing on that.
Well, they mention in the chapter notes here that Cadswain's probably heard Rand and his various mutterings about the colors, and probably has an understanding that she knows that Rand probably has a way of figuring out where Perrin is. If nothing else, we know that Rand sent Perrin away in the first place. I mean, that's why Perrin left, was that Rand sent him away. So, you know, Cadswain's probably fairly confident that Rand knows, at least in general, where Perrin went, but because she can't address him himself, you know, she needs Nynaeve, because Nynaeve is one of the few people who Rand trusts. And, you know, and obviously this, you know, brings into mind, well, you know, why is Perrin necessary for, you know, why is Perrin necessary to help Rand? You know, why will that make Rand's mental state any better at all? And, we don't get the answer here. We kind of get a nod to it, you know, that it's not necessarily Perrin that they're looking for, but someone connected to Perrin. And, you know, I'll admit the first time I read through it, I'm like, I have no idea who they could possibly mean, and, you know, and, you know, the true answer, which will be coming up in chapter 47, was not even amongst the list of people I thought that were going to end up showing up. So, you know, I have to kind of give kudos to, you know, for as much as I'm usually able to catch and pick up ahead of time, that was just not something that I ended up seeing. It also should be noted amidst the tech, if you happen to be reading along or have just read the chapters when you listen to the podcast, you will note that we said that Aemys adds that Egwene also has great honor. In the original texts, original copies of the book, they attribute the line to Sulin. And this is actually a piece of errata which will be corrected in later editions of the book. For those of you who have been reading along the chapters recently or have been reading along as we do the podcast, you may note that we attributed Nandera to leading the maidens who go with Rand to the Barrow. This, in fact, is a piece of errata. The original versions of the text state that Sulin leads the maidens, and as far as we can tell, Sulin is still with Perrin. So that is obviously incorrect, and in later editions they will correct it and state that Nandera is the one who is leading the maidens that accompany Rand. So.
And Tardashar will be a gelding again. Okay. Oh, dude. I'm just so proud of that, because that was, as far as I know, I was the first person to catch that. Jason actually gave me the catch and told Maria, so. I was like, wow, finally a contribution. Though I don't think I'm going to get the kind of mention that Jason and some others will be getting, which is pretty cool. But he didn't hear me say that.
Never can tell.
Anyway. Yeah. Well, anyway. Well, actually, I can. But it's not because I'm psychic. I'll tell you later. So anyway, I think that we'll probably wrap up this episode. There are a lot of ways to get a hold of us, which we will mention later, but if you have any questions, comments, think we missed something, want to expound on something that we've mentioned, just, you know, let us know, and we'll be glad to bring it up when we go over these again.
Yes, we always enjoy hearing from the listening audience, and usually we are in contact with anyone who gets a hold of us as soon as we are able to be. Following our recap episodes, we will probably do another listener feedback episode, including voicemails and emails that have been sent to us and comments that have been posted on both the old and new Dragonmount site. So look forward to that in the future. And I think that will pretty much wrap up this particular episode.
Yep, I think so too. And we will be back for the remainder of the chapters, a couple more episodes, I'm sure, as soon as we can possibly get everybody together. Again, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy going through these books as much as we do. It's a lot of fun for us, and it's a privilege to have people actually listen to us and care a little bit what we think, because we really like doing this. So thank you again, everybody, and this is Virginia. saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian Indoman Shima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by Dragonmount.com. To contact us, visit our website, bit.ly/fourthage.
Hold on a second. I've got a cat in a box in a bag. For a moment there, I was mildly thinking that since this topic has actually branched and is more about Arengar than the Forsaken in general, and that maybe we should entitle the episode Dude Looks Like a Lady. I'm sorry, I just got an influx of cat on book on lap.
Bella's the Dark One.
No, we determined Bella's the creator.
She wants you to think she's the creator. Bella's the Dark One.
Hold on, just a second.
Okay.
Sorry, I had a cat trying to get into a closet.
These cats are something else, aren't they?